Hello, and welcome to Life's Little Mysteries with Live Science. I'm Gina Briner, Editor-in-Chief at Live Science.
And I'm Mindy Weisberger, a Senior Writer at Live Science.
Today, we're bringing you a special episode of Life's Little Mysteries. Usually, we keep things pretty light, but this time, we're going to focus on a serious topic that everybody is talking about, and that's the SARS coronavirus 2, the virus that causes the disease COVID-19.
At Life Science, our reporters and our editors are tracking the latest coronavirus developments around the world, from global case numbers and quarantines to vaccine development to best practices for safety, prevention, and treatment.
Here with the latest coronavirus news is Life Science health reporter Nicoletta Lanice. She's at the forefront of our coronavirus coverage.
This episode was recorded on March 19th and features Nicoletta's weekly coronavirus update and Q&A on Facebook Live. Link to the video is in the show notes.
Hi, we're here with Live Science, and we are bringing you your weekly COVID-19 update. COVID-19 is the disease caused by the novel coronavirus SARS-CoV-2. So this is our seventh live stream so far, and we are here to answer your questions. But first, I'll be starting with a brief update on all the news we've covered this week, which is a lot, so my spiel might be a bit longer today, and then I will open up the floor to your questions. Naturally, in the news in general, we've seen a shift away from the epidemic as it was centered in China, onto how it is now spreading around the world. And specifically, we are here based in the US. Today, we are streaming again from a remote Brooklyn location instead of our Manhattan office because we are practicing social distancing during this time. So just to give you an update on the numbers in general, these are changing constantly. So I'm going to give you rounded estimates as reported by the Johns Hopkins virus dashboard. So worldwide, we're seeing that there are over 227,000 cases currently, confirmed cases being those that have been formally diagnosed, not an actual number of cases. Actual number of cases would be higher than that number because of a limited amount of testing worldwide. So far, there have been more than 9,300 deaths associated with the virus, and more than 84,000 people have recovered after having a confirmed case of the virus. So again, these numbers are constantly in flux, and you will see them updating multiple times a day. Within mainland China, there are more than 81,000 confirmed cases at this point. But as of today, China reported no new local cases within the country. So that means those from being new cases from people who live within China and have not traveled recently. There were 34 new cases reported yesterday, but these were all from people who had traveled to China from elsewhere, according to the New York Times. So experts have said that we will need to see at least 14 consecutive days with no new infections from China for the outbreak to be considered over there. And there is always, once the travel within China becomes less restricted, there's always a chance that we could see a resurgence. But if we see 14 consecutive days with no new local cases within China, that phase of the outbreak will be considered over. So that's a major development as of this week. Within the U.S., there are now 9,415 cases. And again, you'll see that number go higher probably minutes after this live stream ends. Overall in the US, there have been 150 deaths and 106 people have recovered from the virus after contracting the disease. And again, our numbers in the US are a bit skewed at the moment because there is a limit to our capacity even now to conduct diagnostic testing. This has been ramping up in the last week because the federal government has now given the go-ahead to private labs, academic institutions around the country to begin developing their own diagnostic tests, validating them in-house, sending off a letter to the CDC, FDA, to give them notification that their test is complete. And then they can begin using that for diagnostics more locally. So kind of on that front, we're seeing a lot more drive-through testing become available all over the U.S. We made a quick video about this if you want to catch up on what states had this drive-through testing available first. So the drive-through testing isn't a true drive-through like a fast food restaurant where you can come at any time and be served immediately. But if you call ahead and it's available in your area, they can schedule an appointment for you. And rather than having to enter a medical facility, you can be tested outside the facility and quickly triaged if you receive a positive from the test. So that's a positive development, and hopefully we see more and more of those as the weeks go on. In terms of, I wanted to touch in on how development of antivirals and other treatments are going. So this week we saw that a flu drug that was originally developed in Japan seems to show some efficacy in treating the virus. So this drug is called, I'm going to butcher this name, favipiravir or Avigan, but it's an antiviral drug that has shown positive outcomes in clinical trials that included more than 300 individuals in China and Shenzhen, Wuhan and Shenzhen. So it appeared to shorten the duration of the illness in people with milder cases of the disease and improve lung conditions as assessed by X-ray diagnostics. It seems to be a less effective treatment for more severe cases of the illness, but given the large ratio of mild to moderate cases versus more severe, it could still help a lot in treating these patients, presuming it continues to show efficacy in further clinical trials. So this drug works by essentially crippling an enzyme that helps the virus to replicate. So it's a enzyme. Enzymes are substances that allow kind of kickstart chemical reactions in the body. So this enzyme called RNA polymerase helps to build RNA, which is the genetic material that forms the basis of this new coronavirus. So when the virus infects a cell, it injects this genetic material, and then its whole purpose is to churn out as much of that genetic material as possible and then continue to spread. So this works by helping to stymie that replication, is the idea. So that's a positive development as of this week, and hopefully we see that being used in larger groups of people to see if it's widely effective. In other treatment news, there's a new study from China. They were trying a combination of two antiviral medications that were pre-existing and are normally used to treat HIV. It's called Keletra, is the name of the medication. And this has not been shown to be effective against this new coronavirus. And this was in a group of about 200 individuals in China who underwent this clinical trial. So that would appear to not be a fruitful avenue of treatment. So that's Keletra, which is a combination antiviral. Some labs are trying pre-existing anti-malaria drugs, but we don't yet have enough data to know if those are effective. And then you probably have heard about the various clinical trials for an experimental antiviral drug, which is called remdesivir, which was originally developed for treatment of Ebola. Now, in clinical trials for the Ebola drug, it was shown to be safe in patients, meaning it didn't cause severe adverse side effects, but it was not very effective in treating the Ebola virus itself. But they're hoping that because it, both the Ebola virus and this new one, again, are based on RNA, which is a type of genetic material, and this drug works by, just like DNA, RNA is built up of these tiny building blocks that fit together in a sequence. So the drug actually mimics one of these building blocks and squishes itself into the RNA strand, thus creating, quote unquote, a typo in the sequence and rendering it useless, is the idea. So there's multiple clinical trials that are looking at the use of this antiviral, and hopefully we'll get results very soon from those, or at least preliminary results. Related to treatment, this week we saw the first person in the U.S. receive an experimental vaccine to treat the novel coronavirus. This is a vaccine that was created by the pharmaceutical company Moderna, and the NIH in collaboration. So this vaccine is based on technology rather than taking, like more conventional vaccines, a disabled or weak version of the virus and introducing a bit of it into the body to inoculate the body against the virus. This works by generating a bit of mRNA, which is involved in building proteins. So it contains instructions on how to build different proteins. And this is a molecule found in cells, but viruses also use it to replicate within the body. So what this mRNA molecule would do is once inside the body, it instructs cells to build a protein that's typically found on the surface of the SARS-CoV-2 virus. So once this protein is floating around in the system, the immune system recognizes that and builds antibodies to target and latch onto that protein. So in this way, without introducing the virus itself into the body or causing disease, it's thought that you can trigger an immune response, build up antibodies, and help people to fight off the virus if they ever come in contact with the real one. So that's the theory underlying this new vaccine. They've done very preliminary studies in some mice models, but they're already fast-tracking it to human experiments. And this is just an initial phase one trial, meaning they're looking to see if it's safe in people, doesn't cause horrible side effects, and then they will be seeing if they can find evidence of it kickstarting that immune response that I talked about. But mostly this phase is about safety. So it will include 45 individuals in total. And then barring the results of that, it will move on into phase two, phase three trials. If it passes the phase three trial, it can be approved for widespread use. There's another vaccine that follows similar technology. It was developed by, or is being developed actively by Inovio. And they've done some preliminary studies in mice and guinea pigs. And they've published preprint results, so not reviewed yet, about the efficacy of that vaccine. And they're anticipating that a trial will launch around April, so fairly soon. So that's also in the works. I'm going to open the floor. I still have a few more things that we covered this week, but we're about halfway through now. So I'm going to open the floor to some of your questions and then maybe hop back into the updates I've pre-prepared here. So this I was going to touch on anyway, and this is an important topic to breach, is we've heard a lot about Advil and ibuprofen this week because the French Minister of Health, French Health Minister, mentioned in an address that people with COVID-19, this is a quote from him, and I will explain where this comes from in a moment. He's warned that people with confirmed cases should avoid anti-inflammatory drugs like ibuprofen or cortisone and recommends that you use acetaminophen or Tylenol instead. So this claim stems from a letter that was published in The Lancet, which is a journal, that proposed the theory that these drugs boost production of a receptor on cells called ACE2, which has been found to be the same receptor that the SARS-CoV-2 virus uses to infect cells. So that is the receptor that the virus itself plugs into, so to say, and uses this as an entry point into the cell. So based on this letter, which is not backed by formalized studies at this point, the theory is that these drugs boost production of that receptor and then would make it so that with more receptors available, the virus could more easily infect cells, is the theory. There is not clinical or culture data to back up these claims at this point. So the WHO has come out and said that they cannot recommend against the use of ibuprofen at this time for treating people with COVID-19. There's just not enough data. We can't say whether it has a positive or a negative effect, because we simply don't know yet. So before you throw out all your ibuprofen, know that, take all of that, what's being said right now, with an enormous grain of salt. There is, of course, with mild disease, if it induces a fever, if you have a low fever, that's a sign of the immune system you know, coming into action and fighting off an illness. So when you have a low fever, generally it's recommended that you not pound anti-fever medication anyway, because that's a sign of the body fighting off the illness. Now, if you have a severe pneumonia, using anti-fever medication is pretty common within healthcare settings because you don't want that fever to run out of control, because at that point, it is no longer helpful to you. So there are different purposes, appropriate uses of anti-fever medication. Clinically, doctors prefer ibuprofen or Tylenol, or, you know, their equivalent formulations, kind of on a case-by-case basis. So medical professionals know what they're doing on this front. And there simply isn't evidence connecting fever reducers to more severe cases of COVID-19 at this point. That'll be something that clearly we're paying attention to. And people will probably now pursue studies, if they're not already underway, at a more mechanistic level. So we can see if, number one, if there is a boost in receptors, that does not automatically mean that there will be more infected cells and more copies of the virus made. So we don't know that for sure yet. And we also don't know if the sheer number of viral copies present in the body is directly correlated to severe disease. So clearly, if the virus is replicating in the body, that's a sign that you're infected actively. But we don't, it depends on where those viral loads are concentrated. And this is information we're now gathering, now that we have more people with the virus that we can study actively. So this claim by the French health minister has raised a lot of questions that are currently under investigation. So don't panic about ibuprofen is my main takeaway from the story. So I'm getting another question about the Japanese flu treatment. So I just mentioned this a moment ago, but I'll recap quickly for those of you just joining us. So there is a flu treatment that originated in Japan initially, and it's shown some efficacy in treating COVID-19 in a clinical trial of about 340 individuals, I believe. So still fairly small, but among these individuals, it seemed to help to shorten the duration of the illness and improve lung conditions as assessed through X-ray. It seems to be less effective at treating the more severe cases of the illness. So mild to moderate infection seems to be most affected by this drug so far. But again, it's only 340 individuals as of yet with this clinical trial, but that's pretty promising that you're seeing any result at all. And this drug works by basically putting a stop in the system that the virus uses to replicate. So it needs to build RNA, genetic material, in order to replicate. And this helps to break or cripple the enzyme that is required to build new RNA, is how it works. So I hope that answers your question. Someone's asking me if we have concrete proof about where the virus originated. So the virus has been tracked back as far as November, and then still within China. So that's as close as we've gotten to patient zero so far. So that's as far as we've been able to track the virus back so far. That's the only thing I've seen concrete evidence about. It may be that we can track it back even further in the future, and I'll let you know. We'll definitely write about that if that were to come to light. But at this point, it seems most likely still that it originated within China. I've been getting a lot of questions about disinfectants this week, so I just wanted to talk about some good ways to disinfect surfaces in your home. So I'm just going to read a passage from a recent story written by our general reporter, Yasmin. If you're wiping down commonly touched surfaces in your home, disinfectants with 62 to 71% ethanol, 0.5% hydrogen peroxide, or 0.1% sodium hypochlorite, which is bleach, can all efficiently inactivate other coronaviruses that we know about. And experts expect that COVID-19, similarly, when exposed to these harsh cleaners, its membrane will become disrupted and basically dissolve, which kills the virus. diluted household bleach solutions and alcohol solutions containing at least 70% alcohol should be effective at disinfecting surfaces against the coronavirus. So this bleach solution can be prepared by mixing 5 tablespoons of bleach per 1 gallon of water or 4 teaspoons of bleach per quart of water. But please remember not to mix household bleach with ammonia or other cleansers, because these can create toxic fumes. So I'm getting more questions about vaccines. So to reiterate, there is one vaccine trial already underway in the U.S. It began this week in terms of the actual administration of the vaccine in volunteers. So this is being conducted in 45 healthy volunteers in the Seattle area. And these 45 individuals were received 2 doses of the vaccine. They're split into 3 groups. Each receives a different dose. So these early studies, phase 1 clinical trials in general, are to evaluate the safety and adjust dosing of the vaccine and to start to examine the immune response in people. So we want to understand how different people metabolize the vaccine, what happens to that vaccine once it's in the body. So that's being monitored. We want to see if their immune system does in fact begin to build specific antibodies that react to the vaccine. And then generally speaking, just to see at each dosage what kind of reactions occur, if any, because that will help determine in wider populations, larger populations, what the dosing should be among different individuals. So that's the vaccine trial that's ongoing in the U.S., and there's a second that will likely start in April that uses a similar technology in terms of introducing genetic material into the body, which then instructs cells to build proteins that are present in the virus or on the virus, and in doing so theoretically prompts an immune response from the body. Also, this week we had an interesting study come out about potential reinfection by the SARS-CoV-2 virus. So in a small study of rhesus macaques, which are a type of monkey, scientists exposed these macaques to the virus. They did develop a mild infection with symptoms similar to humans, and they developed antibodies. They tracked this immune response through time. Eventually, the monkeys tested negative for the virus. They no longer showed symptoms. And then they reintroduced the virus into 2 of the macaques. And the viral loads within the monkeys did not go back up. They did not develop symptoms again, although they had a brief period where their body temperature went up a little bit and then it dropped back down to normal. So it would appear in this small preliminary study that macaques, at least, cannot be reinfected with the virus after infection. But this is, again, within a very short time period. So the study between the first exposure and the second exposure, there was only 28 days. So this is a very short time window, clearly. So the monkeys essentially just recovered from the first virus, and then they were reintroduced to the same dosage. So looking forward, experts say it would be great if we could see, number one, a larger group of non-human primates, a larger animal model, and then see if we can extend that timeline to see how long immunity can be sustained after that initial exposure to the virus, and whether that correlates directly with the number of antibodies present in the body, the type of antibodies, because antibodies come to recognize different portions of a pathogen. So they're built to latch on to different aspects of the virus. So it might be that certain antibodies are more protective than others. So that would be really interesting to know in monkeys, and then follow up with clinical studies in humans to see if there's a correlation there. But that's a really neat study that begins to answer questions about immunity to this virus. Getting another question. We are being told to wash hands, surfaces, etc. How should we watch produce? So I believe washing produce, rinsing off produce as you normally would, should be adequate. There haven't been studies specifically about, there's been studies about commonly touch surfaces in terms of copper, in terms of stainless steel, plastic, cardboard, things like that. That I'm aware of, there have not been studies on, say, if you touch a tomato at the grocery store, how long could the virus last on there? One thing which would be good is if when you're out at the grocery store, if you can avoid touching surfaces that other people touch frequently. And also if you're shopping around for produce, general rule, common courtesy perhaps, is if you pick up something, that's a thing you're going to buy, hopefully. So that is one thing to be cognizant of, obviously. And if people are washing their hands frequently and disinfecting their hands frequently, you have less chance of transmission. That said, the virus can only live so long on various surfaces. So if you are nervous about fresh produce, it might be in cooking it, of course. Viruses generally can't survive above certain temperatures. So commonly that's a way of disinfecting. But it's a fair question. I think we'll follow up on that. This is kind of, you know, an adjacent to science question, but I've been seeing people on social media, etc., out and about socializing, gathering a large groups of people. I'm wondering if there's anything we can say to these individuals about, you know, playing their part and attempting to socially isolate themselves. In some places, you're going to see that become more of a mandatory measure. So, for instance, we've seen in California that people are now, quote, sheltering in place, which is where there's actual instruction from the government to limit your time out in public spaces. There's mandates as to all over the place as to public gatherings above a certain size. So you'll find that people generally will have fewer and fewer options if they want to be out and socializing, which is part of why the government steps in and does that. Because if people, for instance, people are out and about here, but we've been told here in New York this week that we should be prepared within the next few days to also shelter in place. So you'll soon see more, I think you can predict more instruction from top-down sources to kind of get that under control. Of course, it's on a case-by-case basis how you want to approach people about that. But I find that talking about it in terms of a community-wide effort is really important. So in pandemics of this scale, you're not talking about effects on the individual. You're talking about effects that touch everyone in a community. And that's from the micro-level community, like the people who live on your street with you, all the way up to the national level and the global scale, clearly. Every single individual has their part to play in that. And if you think about the people that you pass by on the street every day, the people that you interact with at the grocery store, just people out and about, all the faces you see and all the people living their lives day to day on a normal basis, how many people you come into contact with, even if perhaps you're in a, quote, low-risk demographic, note that anyone can contract a fairly serious illness from this. It's not, don't brush it off. Even if you're young and very healthy and you're statistically unlikely to die from the virus, there is a subset of young people who will die from this virus. They already have. So no one's immune, firstly. So if you want to put it in terms of, there is a degree of protecting yourself and taking these measures as well. But you can also share with them some of our coverage and others' coverage about how much asymptomatic and mild spreaders are contributing to this outbreak. Truly, they call them almost stealth spreaders because they carry the virus around, they go to a bunch of different locations, they give it to people who perhaps are more vulnerable, and this drives up the case count at baseline, but also the number of people who develop more severe illnesses. If you want to just day by day now, you're going to see more and more hospitals running out of supplies. People are already running out of the N95 respirators that are needed desperately to help protect our healthcare workers, which are the people, you know, truly fighting this on the front lines. So just things like that. If you can do your part in any way by staying home a bit more, by, you know, not gathering in large groups, all that sort of thing, you are serving your community in such a important way. Those are my major points when I talk to people about it, that it's truly a community-wide effort and we're only as strong as our weakest links. And the more socializing and living your life as you normally do, the weaker that link becomes. And that is where my speech will end. So just to end on this anecdote, actually, if you want to, this ties into that previous discussion we were having. There's a really interesting, almost like a case study that took place in a small town in northern Italy. So this town maybe has 3,000 or so people, and it was the location of the very first death that the country experienced from the virus. After this death, the city was put on total lockdown, and every individual was tested in the town. Again, it's a fairly small town, statistically speaking. And they found that 3% of the individuals in the city tested positive for the virus, although about half of them weren't yet showing symptoms. They isolated these people and maintained a lockdown for about 2 weeks and then retested and found that the percentage of people still with testing positive for the virus was significantly lower, below 1%. They kept these people isolated and gathered up the ones who tested positive the second time, lifted the lockdown, and they have seen no new cases since March 13th. So as of a number of days ago, nearly a week now. So this was a dramatic case study of how extreme social distancing and quarantining measures appeared to have worked at pretty much shutting down the virus in the small town. I don't know that these measures can be taken on such a national scale as we would require in the US to see as dramatic results. But social distancing in general is introducing an aspect of that measure. So social distancing is the most mild version of what we could be doing at the moment. So if you want to hold that up as a case study of what we're seeing actively right now happen and how different localities are reacting to the virus, that's also a more straightforward study that you can share with your friends and be like, this is working other places. If we can contribute in a small way to our community, that would be great. Someone's asking me to clarify, so you can be a carrier but not have the virus. So you can technically have the virus in your system and be, by not have the virus, I assume you mean not be infected. So it may be that we are still learning more and more about this every day, but some people simply don't show a super strong immune response to having the virus in their system. So the idea is they either don't develop symptoms, at least not at first, or they show such mild symptoms you can't really tell that they're ill. So in this way, you can be carrying the virus around and still shedding it significantly. Shedding it meaning you're depositing it on surfaces, you are spewing it into the air, should you cough like I did when I had a scratch in my throat unrelated to illness, etc. So yes, asymptomatic and mild to moderate cases contribute significantly to the spread of this is what we're seeing so far. And there have been preliminary studies that suggest that within the first 1 to 5 days of you starting to experience symptoms, so those really mild symptoms that you would experience at the start of a respiratory infection, is when some people are at their most contagious. So they're shedding a lot of the virus at that time. With the SARS virus that caused an outbreak in 2002 and 2003, you saw that people were at their most contagious later on in the disease. So the disease had already settled into their lungs. It wasn't up in the upper respiratory tract, which is what causes those dry coughs associated with this disease. So in this disease, it seems like people might be at their most contagious earlier, which is part of why we think is part of why we might be seeing such rapid spread, because people are still able to move out and about in the world, but they're spreading the virus actively as they do so. So that's the answer to that question, as far as we know at the moment, which is why social distancing measures across the board are important, because there's people who don't realize they have this, who are actively spreading it in their communities otherwise. We're coming up about 45 minutes into this, so I'm going to wrap up for today. If you have further questions, a lot of these topics have been broached on livescience.com already. We've written articles, and we will continue to do so in the coming weeks. And you can also pose more questions on our forums, forums.livescience.com. And again, thank you for tuning in, and I hope you and your loved ones are safe and healthy at this time.
Thanks for joining us for this special coronavirus report from Life's Little Mysteries with Live Science. You can find all the Live Science coverage of the coronavirus and COVID-19 on our website at livescience.com/topics/coronavirus.
We'll be refreshing our FAQ and coronavirus updates daily as information becomes available. The link is in the show notes.
If you have questions about coronavirus or COVID-19, you can post them on our Live Science forums and on Facebook.
Thanks for joining us, and stay healthy.
Life's Little Mysteries is produced in conjunction with Audio Boom as part of their Audio Boom Originals network.